Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonia Rappaport.
And today, Sonia, we have yet another special guest. Mm-hmm. Continuing on Fan Appreciation Month or Season, or it's not been properly titled. But either way, I'd like to welcome Tom Quay to the podcast.
Hey, Tom. Hello. Hey, how are we doing?
Tom, I could tell by your accent, you might be contacting us from very far away.
I am. I'm contacting you from Manchester, England, which is in the northwest of England.
You have a really brilliant radio and podcast voice.
Oh, thank you very much.
Tom, welcome to the show. We know you are one of our super fans, posting regularly at the X-Men Task Podcast Facebook group. It's really cool to have people listening to us from other countries besides the United States. Mm. I didn't even say the episode title. So we're actually on the 8th episode of Season 5, the 72nd episode overall, The Fifth Horseman, which is sort of like a stupidly titled episode. We'll get into that.
Awfully titled episode. Awful episode. Just, yeah, start as you mean to go on.
Yeah, right off the start, not a great episode. Better than Jubilee's Fairy Tale Theater, though, I have to say.
Buy a cigarette paper. Yeah, not bad.
Right. So anyway, Tom, I'm curious. Was the X-Men animated series on when you were a child in England, like just at the same time as on in America, or is there some kind of like lag, broadcasting lag?
It was on at the same time. I imagine there was a lag. With it being the 90s, I think films often came out in America before they came out in the UK. But when it came to programs like that, they were pretty much on the same schedule. So it was a weekly show for us. It was on a show called Live and Kicking here, which is like a Saturday morning breakfast show. And I think it was on after schools at some times. But it was a regular programming, and it was on from pretty much 1992. So that was when I was into it. Here I am now, all these years later.
So let me ask you, were you a comic book fan at the time, or did you stumble on the show, and did you know anything about the X-Men? What was your awareness of the X-Men when it came on television?
So I have two brothers, 4 and 5 years older than me. My brother Lee, who's 4 years older than me, I can credit him with getting me into all this. So he got me into manga and the X-Men, the Batman animated series that was running parallel at the same time. So it was really those two shows that were on at the time that grabbed my attention, and then from those two shows I went into comic books, mainly Marvel, because I just loved the colours and the stories of the X-Men show and everything. And then from that really got me into literature, so I started to, you know, like to read graphic novels. And then, to be honest, I probably credit the show with me doing an English degree in the end, because I got into writing and storytelling that much, but it all started with that show. Absolutely.
Wow.
So it had a really profound impact on your life. That's really cool.
It really did, yeah. And I've got so much love for those writers for not patronizing children. Because at that time, you know, every other kid's show, it felt like, was really dumbed down and, you know, overly bright colors, which is fine, but with no substance behind it. But even being a kid then, I could really feel that there was genuine stories behind it, and there was the themes, which, you know, I'm gay, and being a closeted queer teen at the time, I always read that as a, you know, as a subtext of the show about, you know, hiding your true self, and obviously there's the race angle of it as well, but those themes to me really did come through as a kid, and I really appreciated the writers putting that kind of stuff into it, you know, and not just skimming over it and not just making it about action sequences, which were also incredible as well, you know, the animation was incredible, but there was something behind it, which is why I think the show's endured as much as it has.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the X-Men. You know, the metaphors are sort of well known for how people, you know, like construct the subtext, like you said, and definitely like touching on themes of, you know, the gay experience, or mm-hmm. just alienation in general, and being like a sad teenager is like, I think to me, that's just as overriding, as powerful as anything you want to read into the X-Men.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's why I love the comic and I love the show, is because it really touches on a lot of emotional truths for a lot of people.
It's funny. We were watching a documentary about Walt Disney recently.
Yesterday.
They were talking about how when, was it Snow White first came out, It okay. was like it was the only thing that was aimed at like child audiences that actually had emotional reality to it. There were parts of it that were like so scary and like so sad, and people were like weeping and like peeing themselves because they were so frightened and all this stuff, you know. And like, it was really the only production aimed at children that like had that level of reality to it. And like, when I was thinking about all the other shows that we grew up with, it was like, yeah, you know, it's like Snow White and X-Men, like, hit the emotional truth.
Well, I think Batman, too.
And Batman, yeah,
and the point they made in the documentary was that, you know, because Snow White was the first full-length feature animated movie ever, and they said that it just had a magical effect of transforming people from the realm of reality, sitting in your movie chair, to the realm of pure fantasy, which is what animation can provide. And it works on adults just as well as it works on children. And I think really good animation, like the X-Men, like Batman, they have that effect where you just don't – if it's really good, you don't even realize you're watching a cartoon anymore. You're just fully engaged with the fantasy element of your mind. And when a show like X-Men can touch on like emotional truths, you know, like be it, you know, feelings of isolation and alienation and being like a misfit or being different in some way, it strikes you in like such a deeper emotional level than maybe like a film presentation might, because you're just in this realm of pure fantasy. And I don't know, it just like touches a part of the brain that's really unique.
Yeah, I mean, I just found those episodes so accessible for that as well. I mean, they're only 20 minutes long, but like you say, you lost yourself in them so much. I mean, in my mind, the Phoenix Saga feels like 3-4 hours long, but they're only, what, 4 episodes or something like that? And it's just, you know,
a 5-part episode in a 4-part series.
Exactly. You know, it just feels like such a really big epic tale, and that was just testament to the fact that the writing was so good, the voice acting was so good, you know, and the story at its heart was just incredible, and it maintained that level for the majority of the show.
Yeah, I was going to say, in opposition to that story arc, here we've got the Fifth Horseman.
I want to talk more with Tom, because this, like we said, this episode's not the greatest. How do you feel rewatching some episodes now in your adult years? Do you feel like it holds up? Do you can still get some enjoyment out of it? Is it purely just a nostalgic trip for you?
I mean, these later episodes aside, it absolutely holds up. I just find the quality so incredible. I mean, for the first time, I think last year, I watched the Justice League animated episodes, which I never wanted to watch at the time because
I've recently revisited them as well.
Yeah, just the animation style and all the rest of it. But it was actually incredible, but I was stunned that it was so good. But prior to that, I couldn't conceive that anything was as good as it was back then between Batman the Animated Series and the X-Men show. But no, it really does hold up. I mean, I frequently dip into it to watch my favourite episodes because, it's just, as I say, the quality. I mean, the voice acting more than anything, I think, is what sticks out. I remember.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's something about the voice acting. It's really passionate and earnest, and they're really in the moment. And there's a real edge to all the actors' performances.
And yeah, generally, it feels like they did more than one take on things. You know, it wasn't just, you know, unlike this latest episode, it feels like it was all like, okay, we didn't quite get that, let's do it again. And it really does pay off for me. Genuine gravitas to it, you know.
I've always talked about with Sonya, anyway, that so much of the dialogue in the classic episodes, they're seared into my mind like music.
Yeah,
you know, there's just something musical about the deliveries and the interactions between the characters and the way they deliver the lines. It was really just like a thing of perfection. The Batman show was superior to X-Men overall, I think. But I think X-Men has it matched or even beat on the voice acting in a lot of ways, because it was more of an ensemble performance. And I know they had recurring characters in Batman. And I just think it was just like a different vibe than Batman, which was more of like a solitary episode-to-episode experience.
Yeah.
And X-Men, you had a real like community family vibe of characters that you could swap in and out at times, and go on.
I think that's what I appreciated most about the X-Men show, actually, is the fact that it wasn't just one-off episodes. You know, I think you had the Julia and Eric on talking about the, you know, they took that conscious decision to actually do a thread of narrative, and, you know, they had all that pushback from it. But again, it's about not patronizing the audience. And I really appreciated the fact that it was a sequential story. So, yes, it would be on only week from week, but it was appointment television. So you knew that you had to be home after school to watch the next part of the Big Saga. And, you know, keep it thread.
Yeah, it's funny how they didn't think kids would have attention spans for that, because I remember distinctly being a kid watching some other random cartoon or TV show and naturally just having questions about, you know, like, does Bugs Bunny remember the last time he met Elmer Fudd or something? You know, like, are they, like, is this before or after this other adventure? And as a kid, you just naturally ask these, like, silly questions to yourself as you're watching things. And X-Men was talking – it's a way to really reach a kid's brain is when they have the continuity, because the kids remember – as a kid, if you were like me, you just would watch a repeat too and get a tremendous amount of enjoyment out of – a piece of content, whatever it was, you know, like your favorite movies you would watch 100 times over if you had a VHS tape or something, and you never would get bored. So I think, like, it really, it's like, it's amazing that no one thought that kids had that kind of ability to have that kind of attention span, because it really added to the value of the show.
I don't know if that was really about kids, though. I mean, like, sitcoms and stuff like that of the time were the same way.
There's
I think
an element
that just
to that
was
too,
the style that television – that was the model of television of the time.
Yeah.
And it's really only more recently that shows like Lost or Mad Men or something –
The Wire,
like, came around and made themselves into something that was, you know, drawn out and able to develop characters better and things like that.
Yeah, and I think the show just took it the form really directly from the comics, where, of course, for years they have been telling these long, sequential, continuous stories that have been going on forever and ever. And once you actually, you know, dip your beak into that and you realize that there is a whole world out there, then, yeah, you've just got a massive appetite for it, which is why I'm so happy that I'm still alive for the current episode, to be honest. Just to be able to watch, you know, to see these great, amazing stories actually finally realized and done some justice.
You know, I'm always struck by just, like, the basic premise of Marvel that, like, the closer something holds to the comics when they do an adaptation, the better it is. And it's because those comics, whether they're in, like, you know, the revolutionary but slightly cornier Stan Lee, Jack Kirby days, and then even in the more sophisticated era, there is just, like, something, like, magical in those stories and in the art style that it's, like, all fans, I think, really want is to be as close to the comics and not in, like, some, you know, arrogant, like, nerd way where it must be like the comics or else we're rebelling, but in a way that, you know, that's, like, the fun of the story in the first place was that those comics were so good for decades that there was really no need to improve upon the stories. And the fact when – and that's what made the X-Men show so exciting, is because it was really close to the comics. And that's all it needed to be. You know, and that's all the MCU movies really need to be in a way too. They just need to be realized in a way that matches that original blueprint. And
yeah, agreed. I mean, I must admit, I wasn't a fan of Bryan Singer's adaptations. Just, yeah, that whole turn of the century black leather vibe just, was not for me. It was far too divorced from that comic book look. Not that I say spandex necessarily, but, you know, something a little closer, I think, is what I would like myself.
I agree. I totally agree. But the one thing, to me, it's like the magic of Marvel is that, absolutely, I agree that the Bryan Singer adaptation wasn't as good as it could have been, or it veered too far away from the comics in a way that was kind of cowardly is not the right word, but cautious, I guess.
I'd go with cowardly.
Okay. but my point is that, like, even still embedded in those movies, when they tap into the, like, moments of Marvel magic, you can feel it. And that's, it's like, it's those, like, little drips of, like, pure, you know, happiness, you know, occasionally. Like, I've said, like, one of my favorite scenes in X-Men 1 is when Wolverine, you know, pops his claws and Rogue asks if it hurts, and he's like, every time.
Yeah.
And, like, that's, like, wow. You know, like, that opens up, like, another layer of, like, bridging the world between the fantasy and reality.
But even that, there's a fine line, because then there's the line where, you know, someone makes a comment when they're in the Blackbird about the black leather outfits, you know, and Cyclops, like, snidely or something. He's like, "Whoa, would you prefer yellow spandex?" And it's like,
"Yes, let's take a poll of the audience." Yes.
Well, yeah, but the point is that like they're trying to do fan service, but it takes you out of the moment because you're so aware that they put that in specifically to do fan service that it's like you could have just left it out. Like,
It's just like it's a tough it was a tough balancing act because a lot of it was territory that hadn't been properly navigated. How well do you adapt a comic book to a live action? And it's just, you know, I don't think whoever the filmmakers in Hollywood were had enough confidence yet that people were okay with, you know, for instance, like Superman, give him his red underpants, you know, like it doesn't have to make sense that he has them. Superman has red underwear over his blue pants, and that's just the way it is, and no one's gonna really question it.
Overpants, I like to call them.
Oh, overpants, yeah. They just look good. It just looks more like symmetrically like appealing, and it's, you know, so like when they get,
they should be better than not desaturated as well.
Right. So I mean, it's like you don't have to explain why Wolverine would wear necessarily a bright yellow outfit with like a strange Batman mask thing. He just has it. That's what the character is, and he's cool. I mean, so he allow Wolverine to establish what's believable or not by his own choices as a character, as opposed to assuming that the audience just wouldn't buy it because it might look ridiculous in real life.
Yeah, quite agree.
All right, so finally, let's get to this episode.
You ready?
Well, you know, we were talking a lot about continuity and stuff, and even though this is in the dregs of the final episodes and it's not that great, bizarrely, this episode calls back a lot of things that happened in
That surprised me as well, actually. Yeah. It kind of felt completely out of continuity until they mentioned, what did they mention? Cortez appeared, and that was like, oh, okay, they actually had been met before, and I was like, all right, okay.
Yeah, I know, and it's funny because Cortez, he was presumably killed at the end of the Astro and M episodes, but they show in the final stinger of that two-parter that Apocalypse saves him. And he's like, now you're going to serve me for my ends. And then the next series of episodes is the Beyond Good and Evil. And Cortez plays no part in those episodes. And I was like, what happened to Cortez?
Mm-hmm.
But here he comes back. They finally pay it off. Not that I was like dying to see what happened to him.
Like, I was just not like paying for the payoff.
Yeah, I was like more stunned than anything just to see him return. I was like, oh, they haven't forgotten. And I think that there's a small theme of that that's going to come back later at the end of this episode. But anyway, yeah, so this is an episode about Fabian Cortez. He's alive and well. He's really carved out a nice life for himself. I mean, but it doesn't really open on him. It opens on some bizarre mutants who we haven't really seen before chasing a young mutant character somewhere in South America. Presumably where the ancient Mayans lived.
So Central America.
Oh, Central America then. Yeah. So they're after a character we've never met. These characters are known as the Hounds, as we'll find out. And they're all wearing, like, interesting outfits. They're wearing, like, these tight red spandex with these weird like studded like spikes on them, which to me was, it has to be a reference to the Rachel Summers Phoenix character from the comics. She was the, you know, daughter of Scott and Jean, I think maybe from another timeline or something, and when she emerged in the X-Men main continuity, she was wearing a similar outfit to what these goons of Cortez are wearing.
She had the white leg warmer thing.
No, she was like entirely in red, but she had, I think, like the silver like studded spikes on them. Anyway, so I'm not really that familiar with that era of comics enough to comment about how close or not that, you know, Phoenix had something to do with Apocalypse in that respect, but I think it is a reference. Anyway, so, and one of the Hounds is Caliban.
Right, the Morlock.
Right. Tom, tell me, you might not remember, but was Caliban in any of the episodes prior?
I don't think he was.
Yeah, I mean, it really threw me for a loop when Jubilee was talking about, like, how she knew him.
Yeah, I didn't get this connection at all. I mean, maybe in passing, but
I know, this is why we're a great podcast, because we've literally watched and talked about every episode, and we do not know who's appeared in it. It's just, I mean, there's been a lot of Caliban in the movies these days. He appeared in X-Men Apocalypse as a side character who worked with Psylocke, Olivia Munn's Psylocke, bizarrely. And then he was a totally different character working with Logan in Logan, That was weird how that came out. Played by Stephen Merchant, I believe. And he was a bit more fleshed out there and a bit more human than he was in the X-Men Apocalypse movie, where he was kind of, I don't know, maybe human's the wrong word. Maybe he's just more English as opposed to German. I'm kidding.
I have nothing against this particular character, but I don't really understand why he was given so much attention either in this show or
in the movie.
In the movie, to be honest, he's a bit of a nothing character, I think.
You know, I remember Caliban from the comics briefly. He was in X-Factor when Apocalypse transformed Angel into Archangel. And this, I think this episode actually pulls a lot of themes from those X-Factor issues, because in those issues, Apocalypse does something to Beast that makes Beast super strong and way more powerful than he was. And this is before Beast is the blue monster. It's just when he's still in his human form. No, I think he reverts Beast to human form from the blue monster. But he increases his strength, but it's also making Beast stupider, and it's also killing him at the same time. So there's some like weird body morphing going around with Beast and Apocalypse from those comics eras too, and this episode kind of touches on that as well, as we'll see. But anyway, yeah, Caliban, maybe he was in the background of some Morlock episodes that we don't remember, like the Christmas special or something.
Maybe.
Nothing good, nothing memorable, obviously. He's not like our buddies Leech or Callisto.
Oh, no, he's not an A-list Morlock.
No. Right. So anyway, coincidentally, Jubilee and Beast are on some kind of archaeological mission in South America. I guess Beast is doing it as like a reason to get away from the trials and tribulations of being an X-Man. Or maybe Jubilee just ascribes that to him in that moment.
I think she just says, like, oh, that's a nice side benefit of us being on this trip. Thanks for bringing me. This is great.
Right, yeah.
You know.
And another question that arose for me, and Tom, you can weigh in here. Do you think Jubilee, in this half season five, that where the animation's totally changed and Jubilee now has a mullet, do you think it's implied that Jubilee has aged a year?
I think it's implied she's aged about five. I don't really understand. I don't know if it's just terrible animation or what, but all of a sudden she's a young woman who really objects to being called a child now. And I don't know. It makes me uncomfortable. I don't like it.
She's definitely plays more of a starring role in these episodes. And
she's always objected to being called a child, even when she was a child.
That's true.
But that was kind of the point in the beginning, was that she didn't like being called a child. But I don't know how old she was supposed to be when she first joined the X-Men.
15.
But in this episode, she drives the car. Like, she's driving. Yeah. Which means,
Well, I got my learner's permit at 16 in New Jersey. So, you know, I could have driven around with Beast and it would have been legal.
Okay, yeah.
But maybe she's 17 or 18 now. Maybe it's been a few years. But, yeah, I think they did, age her a little bit for these last few episodes. But, anyway, basically what's going around... Cortez is in charge of these mutants, and he needs them to find a vessel for Apocalypse to return, because he's been lost in a void of time and space ever since the X-Men defeated him in Beyond Good and Evil, and he obviously wants to come back to Earth, and so he needs a mutant. And Cortez great power, enhanced his power, and Cortez is kind of living it up in some fancy robes in a South American temple somewhere dedicated to Apocalypse. He's got servants and everything, and they display his power as to, he can add or subtract from a mutant's power by shooting purple waves at them. Mm-hmm. So that's what he does for Caliban. He turns him into, this large hulking, monster creature.
Do we know what Caliban's powers are if he's not affected by Apocalypse?
I think generally his power is to detect other mutants. He might have some other powers going on in the background, too. But he's one of these mutants born not like the good-looking mutants. He's kind of mutated. Mm-hmm. His face has got a weird white pale to it. He's kind of looks like a ghost man or something, or a skeleton face.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little point on his powers, and sorry if I'm jumping ahead,
no,
but
go ahead.
When he actually detects Jubilee and he's going, okay, I've got another vessel. There's a mutant here. She's really powerful. She's not. But anyway, she's really powerful. he seems to, flash in his mind, and he sees her. And then, yet when he actually sees her in real life, he's shocked that it's Jubilee, which I didn't understand. I thought
that's totally true. I didn't even think about that. But, yeah, I totally know what you mean.
Yeah.
They showed a mental image of her, like, in as his if he mind. Was,
yeah, exactly. Just another inconsistency of a terrible, terrible episode.
Yeah, very, very strange. And we know Jubilee is a friend of the Morlocks. That's what was so confusing about it. Because it does seem like they're establishing that Caliban has been a Morlock, but yeah, we haven't met him yet. So yeah. I don't know what's going on there. But anyway, so Apocalypse needs a vessel to return to Earth, which is scarily like the plot of X-Men Apocalypse the movie. This is like basically the opening premise of that film is that Oscar Isaac is just some Egyptian dude that has Wolverine's healing powers in the year like 3000 BC. And they're transferring whoever the previous Apocalypse was into his body. Because he needs, you know, a body that can regenerate, obviously. Uh-huh. And then something similar is going to happen later. He's going to absorb Professor X. That's the ultimate plot. So, I don't know. Like, I mean...
It's also weird
that film is awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in this episode, he's not, like, picky about which mutant is going to be his vessel. It seems like any mutant will do. And if that's the case, then why does it even need to be a mutant? It could just... be any person.
Yeah, yeah, just get out of the void of time and space first, Apocalypse. Like, save yourself. Pick any person. Yeah, then transfer later, perhaps. But, I mean, yeah, and he's going to be transferred to the body of Jubilee. That doesn't seem so great. But then the ending kind of changes the whole thing anyway.
Yeah.
Like, right. It actually contradicts itself. Anyway, what else happens here? Blah, blah, blah. Cortez, you know, he's in charge of these hounds people. They really, I don't know why Caliban's enslaved to him. Like, is Caliban happy being like bigger and stronger than he was? You know, like, why does he have to listen to the orders of Cortez?
Well, that was his chance to get out of the sewers with the Morlocks, right?
I mean, that was his only chance?
Well, didn't the X-Men offer them all safe haven upstairs and a cushy life, but they didn't want that until.
Yeah, none of that. The Morlocks refusing the help of the X-Men never makes any sense. They've got an enormous 100 room mansion in an isolated section of, you know, of like suburban New York. They would be perfectly happy living there, and yet, you know, for some reason they don't ever take the X-Men up on their offer. It almost got to the point where the X-Men stopped asking them if they wanted to stay.
Yeah, I'd stop asking too. Good on them.
Right. So, I mean, there's some, like, stupid stuff that happens. I've already, like, forgetting. Cortez has some... Like, Beast confronts Cortez. You know, they get captured and brought before Cortez. And Beast says, you know, Apocalypse is going to betray you in the end. He's not your friend. And Cortez just gives the most maniacal acting performance. Betray me? Ha 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 ha! Nothing. Like, he's just such a heretical thought in his brain that's hilarious. And then
I actually do really like the voice actor of Cortez.
Yeah.
I don't think he gives a particularly great performance in this episode, but I love how hammy and over the top he is.
He's still got the pedal to the metal with whatever like character choice he made.
Completely
deranged and on like the edge of, you know, bubbling insanity.
But again, though, I feel like he came in and did this very much in one take, whereas I think the Sanctuary episodes, it was kind of like a little bit more, you know, a little bit more methodical. But this one, he just kind of came in and just, yeah, did it.
Right. And then at this point, Cortez blasts Beast with his mutant empowering rays, and Beast turns into a much larger, scarier version of himself with glowing yellow eyes. And we get a classic line from Jubilee where she tells Cortez that you're destroying him, which is, like, to me, like, always the stupidest line in the entire history of the show. It always sticks out to me like a sore thumb when somebody's destroying somebody else as opposed to killing them or even hurting them.
You are unaliving them.
Yeah. That actually works better for me than destroying them. So Beast turns into a more, like I said, ghastly version of himself that seems kind of more mindless in a way, although not quite. And this...
It's almost like the Hulk, you know?
Yeah, that's a good comparison, yeah.
Like, he's conscious, but, like, not fully himself.
Right, he has to find a way to get a grip of himself. He's less...
And he has to smash things.
Right, he's less dexterous with his fingers and stuff in a way. That, you know, it's kind of like Grant Morrison would sort of do the... curse Beast in a way in his comic run. He turned Beast into more of like a feral cat-like creature, and I think they just attributed it to a secondary mutation kind of thing. And Beast was like, instead of being like ape-like, he became more like, I don't know how to put it, like just like wild cat beast-like
feline,
right? And he, you know, he's really sad about it because he can no longer play guitar, and you know, because his fingers, I think he grew less fingers when that happened too. Mm. He went from having five fingers to like three or four or something, and like a claw, and he was really pissed about it. So this is like, you know, on that theme that like beast mutation is not there, there's something like about beast where he's getting like more monstrous as he gets older in a way. And they explore it more dramatically in those Grant Morrison comics, but here it's like, it's bizarre that they even touch on it. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, what happens? So Jubilee's captured. She's going to be the vessel for Apocalypse. Beast himself, he escapes. He finds their car and digging through, like he's literally slashing through the car, and he finds photos of the X-Men and him with Jubilee, and that reminds him that he's a person inside, and he knows he has to act to save the day. What else happens? Oh, then, like, so Jubilee's going to be sacrificed on this under the altar in Apocalypse's temple. I guess in the outside there's, like, three moons aligning or something. It was, like, hard to pay attention to exactly what the plot device was that was going to bring Apocalypse back. But it's some kind of bizarre ceremony. And
it was a celestial conjunction.
Oh, okay. Just one of those.
It's kind of one of those, you know.
I mean, it's just disappointing in real life that there's not more celestial conjunctions going on in astronomy, you know? It just seems in our entire life. I mean, I guess that's why, you know, it was before I was born, but it's why Halley's Comet was such a big deal. Mm. And when you see photographs of Halley's Comet, it's pretty, like, boring, right? It's not this exciting – it wasn't, like, this exciting flash of – magic across the sky. It's just like a little dot you would see through some binoculars, and people flipped out about it, you know.
That's how all comets look.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying that, like, when you see in a cartoon or something, the outer space is awesome.
Stars,
yeah,
and stuff.
Like, yeah. Well, I mean, shooting stars are different. Those you can actually see, and those are probably a little more fantastic.
Yeah.
But like comets in general, though, they're kind of like stayed dots in the sky for a couple of days or something.
And yeah.
They're not that exciting.
Smudge.
Yeah, so I'm saying that, like, you know, in the world of Batman, the moon is like 50 times larger than it is in planet Earth. You know? It's like in here in the with Apocalypse, the celestial convergening. There's like three bodies floating and glowing in crazy colors in the sky. It would just be more exciting if there was more realism to that.
Well, you have to become an eclipse chaser then.
Yeah, maybe. So they dressed Jubilee up in this like ancient Mayan outfit, which I couldn't quite tell if it was inappropriate or not. It's like, is that necessary to give her, you know, some like ancient Mayan garb? Whatever. Here though, Caliban is like, he's fully ready to rebel against Cortez. He's had enough. Jubilee's his friend. He wants to save her, and Cortez like expresses some really bizarre like Morlock racism, which I found kind of stunning, that he considers the Morlocks lesser than he as a fellow mutant. And, I mean, what's the difference between, you know...
That's not that surprising. That's, like, what the Morlocks face in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
And Cortez is, like, not an upstanding mutant citizen,
That's true. I don't know. I do find, like, inter-mutant racism kind of strange, though.
Mm.
That they would, and I actually think that'd probably, like, ring truer to real life in a way. There would be that, like, subdivide in the mutant community.
Mm-hmm.
They'd probably discriminate against each other. You know, we've talked about in the other episodes, like, there's people that were born that just look like dogs. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, it's like a much harder life than if you're born looking like Cyclops, but you just have to keep your eyeballs covered. So anyway, Cortez is racist against Morlock people. Caliban volunteers to be the vessel. And Cortez is like, yeah, you're a Morlock. That's not fitting for Apocalypse.
Mm.
And Apocalypse, by the way, does not look like a normal person either. He's got a very bizarre, you know, face and body structure. So I don't think he doesn't seem that much different than a Morlock in my mind. Beast comes to the rescue. Jubilee is rescued. The temple starts collapsing. You know, Beast is fighting with Cortez, and Cortez, in self-defense, turns Beast back to the regular Beast, which is a relief. You know, things get reverted back to normal. They start to leave the collapsing temple, and, you know, Beast does say, like, should we go back for Cortez? And I was actually surprised. Like, oh, there's not enough time. You know, I thought for sure they would go back and get him. Like, that's a staple of the show, that they always rescue their worst enemies from collapsing buildings.
I actually found that hilarious, the way they cut that. They said, oh, we've got to save him, you know, absolutely must save him. And then Jubilee goes, yeah, but the building's falling down. They go, yeah, you're right. And they just straight out the door.
Yeah, because 9 out of 10 times when someone says there's no time, Wolverine's like, I'll make time, you know, and somebody goes and does it anyway.
Slashes their way in, yeah.
Right, so...
But this guy's been a bit of a bastard, so see you later.
Yeah, he sucks. I mean, and Apocalypse sucks too. It's like weird that Apocalypse comes back at all. Why not just let him die at the end of Good and Evil, Beyond Good and Evil? And so anyway, Cortez is like, he's still alive. And he's like, well, Apocalypse, we'll have to try again later. And Apocalypse says, no, you're perfect. I'm going to just take your body. And he takes over Cortez's body. And I thought for sure that Apocalypse would just have the body of Cortez.
Yeah, I thought so too.
But no, he's Apocalypse. He's just...
He transforms Cortez's body into Apocalypse, which brings up so many questions. Like, why did he need the teenage bodies? Like, why did he need to capture teenagers and have, like, his henchmen do any work?
It seems like it could have been anything, you know, he could have transformed into.
Right, and it's like he rescued Cortez, apparently, from Asteroid M, like, a very long time ago. Why didn't he just take over his body back then? He could have been wreaking all kinds of havoc.
He was waiting for the celestial realignment over the Temple of Apocalypse.
I mean, fine, but still, it's just, like, so much work happened that didn't need to happen.
Yeah, I don't get, you know, I think there's, like, a touch of weird, of, like, the over-morality of the show, that they can't let any character really die, because Apocalypse was vanquished finally, you know, and it's like, why bring him back for one, like, meaningless episode just to say that he's alive again? I mean, I don't think they had any plans of setting up a sixth season. So to me it feels like it's the over morality of the show, that we can't really let any character die no matter how bad they might be.
But he wasn't dead though. He was in some kind of like purgatory state, right? Like suspended somewhere.
Well, I don't remember exactly how he quote unquote died at the end of Beyond Good and Evil. He like gets like blasted into nothing.
Or
like,
was this one of the episodes that aired out of order because of the animation stuff? Were there Apocalypse episodes after this?
Runtime? The end of the series was supposed to be Beyond Good and Evil Part 4. That was supposed to be the finality of the whole thing.
Yeah. And like, this is part of the extended episodes that were ordered later on.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it just seems like they're setting up another Apocalypse episode, but I know that in Season 5 we're not going to get one, right?
Right, no.
I don't think we are.
No, we'll never see him again. We shan't see him again until X-Men Apocalypse the movie.
So really it's just being ominous and saying Apocalypse is out there and looming.
Yeah,
watch out.
Well, you never know. I mean, Disney has reacquired the rights to the X-Men. I'm almost 1,000% certain that they're going to make another X-Men cartoon. My hope is it's not going to be like a crappy show for like angsty tweens.
Yeah, we want a show for 30 something.
Yeah, exactly.
make it for kids, but make it smart for kids.
Right.
No,
make it for everybody. That's my answer.
Something. That's all we want. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. No, but you're right. I mean, ideally, they just pick up with season 6 of the X-Men the Animated Series with the same voice actors who are the ones who are alive. I mean, they'll never do that. You know, I see a lot of people on Twitter always like begging for that. Like, oh, Disney, make it happen.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen.
Start a campaign. Bring Hal Dodd back.
Yeah, I mean, the best we're going to get, they'll do like a Blu-ray release finally of the whole series, something to that end, or they'll just put it on their Disney streaming service. But I don't think they're going to bother like with this continuity at all or style. I just hope that whatever the next X-Men cartoon is, it's just, it's good. It's got like an edge and it's not dumbed down and it's not trying to be too modern and everything. It needs to have an element of timelessness, which I think, even though the show was clearly set in the 90s, I think it still had an element of like, it could have been like any time in the Marvel universe. They're just the classic characters.
Yeah. I mean, the good and bad thing about living through now is that the studios do listen a lot to fans, you know, better or worse. So if they actually are looking at the Twitter sphere, et cetera, you know, they actually will see that people want to show with a bit of something about it. So
I hope so. I mean, you know, and I hope it's good. I mean, my dream, really, and this is a dumb dream, but it's that they make a new X-Men cartoon that's really good, that it allows this show to continue talking about X-Men cartoons in an exciting, relevant way, as opposed to like a nostalgic throwback way. I would love to cover a new, like, awesome X-Men cartoon. But like I said, it has to just be like the right mix. Like, I'm not going to be interested if it's like squarely aimed at teenagers. Like, I hate, you know, X-Men Evolution a lot. There's a ton of our fans that love that show too. Me personally, I just was never liked it. I don't like sticking characters I know in high school in a,
yeah, like, you know,
And I'm not, and this is not to slag Muppet Babies, because I remember enjoying that show as a kid. But it's like the same thing. It's like I'd rather just see the regular Muppets. I don't need to see them like in a different, you know, like
infantilized.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I don't need to see the X-Men like in some scenario where they're not just the regular X-Men. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what we get there. Yeah, so anyway, that's the end of this episode. Apocalypse comes back to life. I guess he's just going to, you know, live out his days in South America somewhere. Maybe maybe he doesn't have plans to just take over the world anymore. He's just going to be a humble farmer or something and, you know, just live by the Amazon River.
So I have a question about Cortez.
Yes.
And his motivations. So in Sanctuary, I was never sure whether or not he actually was genuinely this servile, you know, creep who actually wants to serve any master, because obviously he betrays Magneto in the end, and yeah. I don't know whether that was down to because he thought Magneto betrayed the cause or whether he was just an opportunist. But in this episode, it just seems that he really is that, I don't know, just that kind of strange yes master, and I don't know, that seemed to jar a little bit with me.
I think you hit on a couple things, because in the Astro M episodes, that the writing was way better. And there's a lot more depth to Cortez, and it raises a lot of questions about, you know, who he is, what his motivations and plans are. Here it's like, let's just churn out an episode, let's use Cortez. Yeah. Oh yeah, remember, he was like a real, like, servile, like, whimpering goon. That's what he is, and we'll just go with that. So, in a way, it's like, it kind of, like, kicks dirt over the character they introduced, who was really kind of interesting and had a razor edge to him and was bizarre.
I actually would go the other way. I would say I think this episode reinforces that he is an opportunist, because when Beast brings up, like, oh, Cortez, Apocalypse, like, he's just using you, man, like, get out of this now, you know, and Cortez is like, but I'm so powerful, you know, and he makes a demonstration of his power, and it's like he's really getting something out of this relationship that he has with Apocalypse. It's not it doesn't seem to me that he's just like the sniveling sidekick, you know. He imagines himself to
being the partner of Apocalypse,
or that's why he's surprised at the end, like getting something good out of the deal. You know, it's not like a servitude out of fear. It doesn't.
No, I preferred the guy who actually wanted to take over, though, and, you know, would aim to stab Apocalypse in the back. And I never felt like that was coming from this. Yeah. From this version of the character, you know, just an overall lack of depth, I think, in this version.
Yeah,
definitely. Well, you know, it's like a sad state of affairs going through these last episodes. but Tom, that's why we appreciate you being here, so you can make them a bit more entertaining.
Yeah, pat it out a bit.
So, I mean, that's all I have to say about this episode. Tom, I want to give you a final platform here to say any final words, anything else about the show or the movies or any of your other thoughts in general about the X-Men.
Nothing off the top of my head. I think I've said it all, but just a thanks to you two for doing the show so regularly. As I say, I always appreciated the fact that X-Men stayed to a schedule and it was there every week, and I appreciated this podcast being there every Monday morning, as it is for my time, when I'm hungover and working. So I appreciate that greatly, and yeah, long may it continue.
Now you're part of the canon officially forever, so
bizarre.
We appreciate that, and great. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for coming to Skype.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and I'll say, like, to everyone out there about the show going forward, we're going to try to obviously keep to the weekly schedule as we do, our bizarre desire to just to release an episode come hell or high water. I just do want to give a warning to the fans that both Sonya and I, like I mentioned last episode, we both did just recently start grad school, and this was our first week, and the amount of overwhelming misery we felt, like, not realizing that doing grad school plus having full-time jobs, like, it wreaks havoc on your schedule. So we're going to try to keep doing these as frequently as we can, but there might be some weeks in which it won't be there right away, you know. There might be some delays, especially as we, like, branch past, like, the all the episodes and into the unknown future of, like, what we're going to cover and talk about. So we appreciate everyone for hanging in there, and again, thank you to Tom. I want to do the final plugs. Follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Join the X-Men Task Podcast Facebook group to interact with Tom and ourselves and everyone else that's a super fan. And rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you rate and review podcasts. Give us 5 stars. That probably help us out. Who even knows at this point? And and just thank you again to everybody for listening. Sonia, do you have any final words?
No, I don't have anything to plug. Tom, do you have a business, a website, anything that you want to put out there into the universe?
I'm not sure that anyone would want to see it, to be honest, but if you want to watch me, if you want to watch me do stupid videos and look at pictures of cats and stuff, then you can follow me on Instagram at UTD Nation. That's United Nation.
Oh, very exciting. Cool. Give us an Instagram follow and we'll follow you right back. How about that?
Done.
All right, awesome. All right, thank you, Tom, again, and thank you, audience. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Bye-bye.